The Supreme Court term that concluded last week will be remembered for one thing in particular, the 5-4 decision that picked a president of the United States, the first time for such a ruling. There were other significant court decisions on everything from immigration to search and seizure. As in the case of Bush versus Gore, most of the court's high-profile cases were decided by a margin of one vote. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
This term, one out of three Supreme Court cases was decided by a 5-4 vote. Supreme Court advocate Tom Goldstein does an annual statistical analysis of the court's docket.
Every year we think this court can't get any more closely divided, but it does.
Indeed, Goldstein points out that if you eliminate from the equation the court's business cases, most of which were easily decided with little or no dissent,
the number of 5-4 cases goes through the roof. It becomes about two-thirds or even three-quarters of the cases.
The elephant in the room in terms of 5-4 rulings this year was, by all accounts, Bush versus Gore. Stanford Law Professor Pam Carlin.
The real significance of Bush against Gore is it determined who the president was and may determine who will make the next set of nominations to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Scholarly writing about the case is now pouring in. From Harvard's Alan Dershowitz, who's written a book about it called Supreme Injustice, to federal judge Richard Posner, a conservative but eclectic Reagan appointee who defends the decision, albeit tepidly, in a forthcoming book called Breaking Deadlock.
Decision may be incorrect, but it's not unreasonable, it's defensible.
Court's ruling, he concedes, is somewhat patchwork.
It's not well done, it's not well-articulated, well-reasoned.
But that, says Posner, is likely the result of enormous time pressure and the fact that the court was facing a set of novel issues it had never faced before.
They're just people, these Supreme Court justices. They're not Superman or geniuses, so
you give them
something really novel, chew on, they may get indigestion.
Posner argues that the court seriously misfired when it concluded that the Florida recount violated equal protection of the law. Election law, he notes, has always tolerated different procedures in different counties. And he says if sloppiness constitutes a violation of equal protection of the law, then our whole election system is illegal. The court, he says, would have been far better off basing its decision on Article 2 of the Constitution, which directs the state legislatures, not the state courts, to design the method of choosing presidential electors. Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, who argued part of the case for Vice President Gore, contends that the current court represents a range of ideas from A to C, as he puts it, and that the professional backgrounds of the justices are so similar that ideas are not rigorously tested and challenged in the internal decision-making process. The effect, he contends, in this case, is a decision that, regardless of the result, is seriously flawed.
And that is more likely to happen if the court is monolithic in viewpoint and in experience than if it has a very broad diversity of views and of backgrounds.
The result of an inadequately reasoned opinion, he asserts, is that the court is viewed as partisan.
The court, for the first time in my memory, has a kind of profile in public support which is very similar to that of a normal political figure rather than an institution that plays anything like the oracular role that these guys posit for themselves.
University of Virginia law professor John Harrison agrees that the court's image may suffer at least a bit.
I suspect there will be a little erosion of the court's authority after this.
But Judge Posner contends that the court had little choice but to act. If it hadn't, he argues, the deadlock over the election might well have continued in Congress, and the nation might well have had an acting president for some time. Whoever won in the end, he says, would have had a terrible time establishing his legitimacy.
An election that's decided in Congress tends to leave a poisonous trail. John Quincy Adams, who was elected by House of Representatives in 1824, never really secured the legitimacy of his office. And that, I think, is the strongest practical argument for what the Supreme Court did.
Posner believes that history's view of the court's decision is likely to rise or fall depending on the success of the Bush presidency. University of Chicago law professor David Strauss has a different view.
I think what will strike people as remarkable is that the Supreme Court had a kind of legitimacy in American life that enabled it to step in, resolve a presidential election without any secure legal basis, and get away with it more or less unscathed.
In terms of other cases before the court this term, Strauss, the editor of the Supreme Court Review, and other scholars cite the court's immigration cases, all decided by 5-4 votes, as perhaps the most surprising, because in the past the court has deferred to Congress and the executive branch to determine what sorts of rights were accorded to aliens. Not so this term. The court said aliens could not be held in prison indefinitely because no country could be found to take them, and that certain aliens could not be automatically deported without a court hearing. Professor Strauss.
The difference is this. The court thought that in these cases, there was a principle at stake that really goes back hundreds of years into English and American law, which is that the executive branch cannot deprive people of their liberty without giving them a hearing. And that if there's one thing judges in the Anglo-American tradition have historically have done, it's to protect people against arbitrary deprivations of liberty. That's really the basic thing that judges are there for.
In the civil rights area, the court continued its march for states' rights, ruling by a 5-4 vote that Congress violated state sovereignty when it passed a federal law that allowed suits for money damages against states for discriminating against the disabled. Similarly, the court ruled that individuals cannot sue to enforce their rights against the states under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. That's the provision that bars discrimination by states when they accept federal money. Stanford Law Professor Pam Carlin.
It's important because Title VI is really one of the major sources of anti-discrimination law in the United States, and to say that it can't be enforced by individual citizens cuts back dramatically on the amount of enforcement that is likely to occur.
On the subject of search and seizure, the court made some surprising rulings, with the conservative Justice Antonin Scalia writing that technology, in this case a heat detection device, cannot be used without a warrant to learn more about what's going on inside a home. The more liberal Justice David Souter wrote another 5-4 opinion, declaring that a person can be arrested and imprisoned for an offense, in this case a seatbelt violation, punishable only by a fine. Overall, though, what's striking about this term is the unanimity among scholars and court watchers about the court's confidence in itself. John Elwood is a court commentator of a more conservative bent.
I think that whether you're talking about the election process with the Bush versus Gore case, or immigration in this recent spate of cases we've had, or in even professional golf with the Casey Martin case, it seems that they're much more willing to, if not substitute their judgments, to at least sort of inject their own decisions about the merits of things rather than deferring to other decision makers to do so.
University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein comes from a more liberal persuasion.
The real pattern that emerges is this is a court that really thinks of its own judgments about the law as the prevailing ones, and it doesn't really like to listen very carefully to what other public or private institutions have to say.
Looking forward to next term, don't expect a big change in the 5-4 voting pattern, with questions like affirmative action and the death penalty on the docket. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.